We're also joined by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, everyone.
Peter, I'd like to start with a couple of questions about 38 Studios. Do you support the idea of releasing the grand jury materials related to the 38 Studios investigation?
Yeah, you know, that's a really complicated question. I've been a prosecutor for 20 years. It really requires a balance, right, between the fundamental objectives of a grand jury, which goes back in time, you know, to English law, you know, farther back than the origins of the Republic. So balancing that need for secrecy. So why do you need secrecy? Some of it's obvious. There are lots of cases we investigate where no charges come out, but they may eventually be the subject of public interest. Releasing that material is fundamentally unfair to people who aren't charged. It can also chill people's willingness to come in and talk about what they know. On the other hand, there are certain cases that generate so much interest that I can understand why people would move for the release of those documents. I think that because the grand jury is fundamentally an arm of the court, so the court seats the grand jury, for example, that regulates the grand jury. If you have a problem with a grand jury, you go back to the court. I think it's appropriate, and I don't want to get into 38 Studios specifically because, you know, I don't know all the, other than a member of the public, I don't know most of the ins and outs of that particular matter. But I think that is a case that is almost uniquely situated to go before the court and get a judicial opinion on whether it should be disclosed or not. I don't envy the judge having to make that decision because of the balancing that we're talking about. But I do, from a law enforcement's perspective, I do understand the concern about, okay, if we do it in this case, well, then what about this case?
So you're not going to say whether you support or oppose releasing the grand jury materials?
Not in this particular instance, no, Ian, because it's not a case that I know all of the parameters on, and I don't know what's in those records. But I will say, I will say this, I understand law enforcement, in this case the Attorney General's, and formally Colonel O'Donnell's concern about that issue, because whenever you walk down this road, you are setting a precedent for something you may not like later.
One other question on 38 Studios before we go to Scott. 38 Studios, in some respects, is in the rearview mirror, but it's also still with us. Do you think the state needs an independent investigation to move on from this boondoggle?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I've never felt, as a prosecutor, that I needed anything. Other than my process to get to the bottom of what I was interested in, vis-a-vis of whether or not something was a crime or not. But the criminal justice system is not always the best way to get the kinds of answers the public wants. There are other means, whether, you know, independent investigators can be expensive, and what powers do they have to get to the root of the information? They may not have subpoena power. They may not be able to immunize somebody to compel them to testify the way a prosecutor can. I think legislative hearings may be helpful in that regard. You know, I'm not steeped in the ins and outs of how our state legislature works in terms of its powers to be able to do that. But I'm not convinced that independent investigators are necessarily value added when you're trying to get to the bottom of something.
All right, let's go to Scott.
I'm wondering just how far should we go in basically deputizing police departments as ICE agents here. Mm-hmm. I know there's been a lot of talk about that recently. Commissioner Steve Perry in Providence has voiced some real concerns about this. What's your feeling?
Well, you know, I think that's a fundamental choice that local law enforcement agencies have to make. I think you would probably find different answers in different parts of the country, probably, right? What I can say about my experience as U.S. attorney is that the cases that we focused on, and where I think certainly federal Department of Justice, by that I mean FBI, U.S. attorneys, DEA resources are best spent, are on people who are committing crimes. And I don't mean immigration crimes. I'm talking about serious violent and drug trafficking crimes. So in that context, you know, I think the answer is fairly simple, right? That working with law enforcement to that end makes a lot of sense. When you move yourself to the Department of Homeland Security, which is not my department and something I don't have a lot of experience with, when you're talking about the basic immigration function, well, first of all, those cases don't come to my office at all. I never see those cases. So how those immigration officers interface with, say, the Providence Police Department is not something that I have a lot of insight into. But I do understand, because I've known Commissioner Perry a long time, I have a lot of respect for him. I do understand the view that asking Providence police to do something when they're down 100 police officers, which is not sort of in their ballpark, when they have lots of other real crime to deal with, is something that would concern them. So, you know, again, I think it largely depends on where in the country you find yourself and potentially, you know, what level of immigration issue you're dealing with. Again, if we go back to the kinds of cases we see in U.S. attorney's offices, you know, we may do 9-10 cases a year. If you go to Arizona, as you might expect, or New Mexico, you're talking about thousands of cases where they have a rocket docket to move these cases through. So I think depending on where you are, there may be a different incentive to do that and certainly a different willingness to do it.
We're talking here with U.S. Attorney Peter Nerona. We see how your office periodically makes prosecutions of people in the drug world, illegal drugs sold in poor neighborhoods in Providence and other parts of the state. These people get hefty sentences, and I'm sure the law-abiding people in those neighborhoods are happy to see these prosecutions. But at the same time, it seems as if the flow of illegal drugs is really not interrupted, and other people come along to take the place of the previous criminals. Is there a better way of doing things?
I think you have to separate the issue into two things. One is violent crime, and one is drug crime. I think, you know, for whatever reason, the drug crime is going to continue. The flow is continuous, and the supply is inexhaustible. That's why we really need to work hard on prevention and treatment on the drug side. Violent crime, I think, is the issue that we have tried to focus on in my year. Sometimes we have charged drug cases, but in the context of people who are committing violent crime, the drug charges are a means to attack that violent crime problem. To me, though, you have to focus on, we call it fishing with a spear instead of a net. You've got to focus on the people who are driving crime, and you got to do that proactively. That has been a challenge, though, given the issues that Providence has had. I alluded to it earlier with their staffing. You know, Providence is a huge partner in this. They are really the boots on the ground. For us to be able to be proactive and target the worst of the worst, if you will, they need to be at full strength. But that's really our challenge, I think, in law enforcement. When we're dealing with drug crime and violent crime, focusing on the worst of the worst.
What's your opinion of where the line should be on the federal marijuana laws and medical marijuana and legal marijuana in the states? We see places like Colorado and, of course, Massachusetts next year, again, is going to have legal marijuana. There's kind of a tension in the law.
You know, there clearly is. I mean, you know, I can go back to probably 2010 or 2011 when medical marijuana here first hit the scene, and we were trying to figure out, well, exactly how is this going to interface with what we're doing in the federal government? And it took the Obama administration and the department, you know, some time. I would say 6 months to 10 months to kind of figure out, well, how are we going to handle this? That policy has not changed. I mean, we're only a month into the new administration, and it may change. You know, right now the position is, look, if the states think this is a way to go down, a road to go down, well, we're going to let them go down that road unless the cases fall into certain categories. So, you know, diversion of marijuana from states that have it to states that don't, diversion of marijuana to children, involvement of organized crime or money launderers or the cartels. But short of that, it's a hands-off approach. I think this is another one of those very, very complicated issues. I mean, we could talk about a lot of complicated issues today. We're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out. I don't envy people trying to make marijuana policy today, because it seems a pretty close question if you ask most people. You know, about half the people you talk to might think it's okay, and half the people might think it's not. And so navigating those waters is going to be difficult. And also putting in place the regulations to make, if we're going to go down this road, and there are lots of reasons not to do it, but if you're going to go down this road, how to make it safe and keep it where it should be.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Great to be here.
And U.S. Attorney Peter Nerona.
Thanks, guys.